above-mids or at your feet so other passengers may access as we board them along our route. Restrooms are going to be located down the stairs in the middle of each coach car. Trash receptacles at the end of the coach cars and in the middle of the coach cars by the stairwell there. Also in the lower level areas, if you wish to purchase food or beverages.
He never finished that sentence, did he?
I'm sure he'll finish a sentence. Something must have happened.
I think he got distracted.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, a coup.
This is your sleeper car attendant, Regina, for the 1131 car. This is your attendant.
A lot of distractions on this train. But that's our own personal car. Each car has its own PA system.
You know, one thing I've noticed about this particular room, what are we in, A or F?
This is room A.
Okay, A, a couple things.
Car 1131. We can reveal that.
The bathroom door is sort of by the...
Sorry about that, but once again, this is your sleeper car attendant, Regina, speaking. Just a quick basics about our car. All bathrooms are downstairs. Once again, all bathrooms are downstairs. The diner car and the lounge car will be behind us, so everything will be behind us. Next car will be another sleeper, that is the 30 car. After that will be the diner. After that will be the lounge car. So if you keep going back after the diner, it will be the lounge car. Cafe car will be downstairs. They will come and make an announcement on the PA on how the lounge and the diner works. They do start with lunch today, and they will come to you for reservation. All right, we will be leaving here shortly, but if anyone had any concerns, any questions, please feel free to let me know. I will be walking around. Once again, my name is Regina, and welcome aboard.
I'm sorry, Carl, you were saying?
Oh, I was just saying that there's some awkward things, mainly that there's no place to put your bags. So I was talking about the bathroom door, which is sort of right by the regular door. And then there's basically a flat wall right where you're sitting in, like, the captain's chair, which on other superliners spins around or folds up and spins so you can open the door to the shower or the bathroom. Since it's located on the other side, it sort of opens up into a wall, so you can kind of almost open the shower door all the way. It's like three quarters of the way, but that ends up being the only place I can set my bags, between the wall and the door to the bathroom.
Also, ladies and gentlemen, please remember all the restrooms are where you boarded the train. So wherever you got on the train, that's where the restrooms are at. There are no restrooms in any food service cars, which means that we sell or serve food.
It's not entirely true, because we have a restroom here in our room, and we're upstairs, but I guess he doesn't want to let other people know about that. But you know what, Kyle, I think because of where this is the first room in the car, room A, it might be that way on all superliners.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking specifically A. It wasn't so much this particular train car or train, but A, that configuration is what you, or this is what you get with that configuration.
Now, as you may be assuming or figuring out from the noise, we are moving. We left on schedule, 9:45 in the morning. And maybe, Kyle, this is an opportunity for you to describe to the listeners the sights of Seattle that they're not seeing right now.
Yeah, no, I'm very excited. This is really fascinating. SoDo, South Downtown area, lots of graffiti, lots of industrial warehouses. Oh, there's the dump. There's the transfer station. That's where all the garbage goes. Look at that.
People here are so fascinated by dumps. Why is that?
Well, every day, a train a mile long takes all the garbage out of Seattle.
Look at all those containers. That's all for garbage?
Yes.
That is impressive. You guys are doing a good job. I mean, New York has you beat on garbage, but still, this is impressive.
That's my friend's warehouse.
We were there, weren't we?
Yeah, it's an old locomotive factory, and they do incredible bicycle stuff and other art events and production type stuff. It's kind of a bunch of people using sort of in a mixed-use configuration.
What I love about Seattle is that the train passes by everything. So your friend had a warehouse, and of course the train passed right by it, and we just saw it, and there's all kinds of other things we can see.
Yeah, I'm looking for peace vans, or there's a bunch of different, like, Volkswagen bus and van shops in SoTo, and a lot of enthusiasts for that. So those kinds of businesses, like industrial or mechanical, that kind of stuff really thrives in South Downtown. So it's really cool to see it from the train perspective, because you're in the backyard of everybody's stuff.
Well, you know, I've never seen so many buses, VW buses and VW bugs as in Seattle.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Michael here in the dining car. I want to welcome everybody aboard Amtrak's CoStar Line. Dining car's closed at this time. And the next meal period will be lunch. We're going to take reservations for the bedrooms for lunch at this time. So if you're in a bedroom, please have those doors open and have those curtains drawn. Because if you have them closed, we'll assume you want privacy, and you won't get a reservation. So, I'm going to be going through the bedrooms at this time. Take reservations for lunch. If you're in a bedroom, please have a member of your party in there with your door open and the curtain drawn. Thank you.
Okay, so now we're along Airport Way, and this is the bridge on Airport Way that goes over all the train tracks into Georgetown.
Well, as Kyle's opening up the curtain so that we get a lunch reservation when the guy comes by, I am admiring the scenery and recognizing a lot of the scenery, too. We're passing something called the Olympic Foundry.
Yeah, they make all the weights for Genie lifts. So if you ever use a Genie lift that, like, has a basket and is for, like, working on things really high up, they pour or they forge all of the iron counterweights for those Genie lifts, and then they're put together out at an airfield in eastern Washington.
I was mentioning before about the VW bugs and buses. I've seen so many of those around here. Apparently you can rent some, that we see shops that do nothing but work on them. And I just wanted to mention, if anyone has one that they'd like to give to Off the Wall, we will happily accept it. You know, it has to be from the 1960s or the 1950s. We'll accept that as well. You know, a VW bus or bug, because, boy, they're awesome.
Yeah, any condition. We'll consider some exceptions, of course.
I don't want a rust bucket, I'll tell you that. But, you know, if it just needs a paint job, yeah, we'll consider it.
Yeah, because we probably won't paint it, but we'll still take care of the paint. But a lot of tin work and rust is a little bit harder to work its way back into something safe. But we would like to open up the history books, as I've been saying, and learn a little bit more about some of the older vehicles. And there's a lot of really cool conversions now. I hear there's a kit to make them electric, so I'm kind of into it, and it's a cool old style of vehicle.
So are we passing Georgetown yet?
Oh, we're well past it. We're just passing the terminal for KCBFI. That's King County Boeing Field International.
Oh, there's Boeing Field over on the other side. We're only looking at one half of the train, but I can see, since you drew the curtains, that Boeing Field is over there. That's not a commercial airport. That's just for, what is it for exactly?
Yeah, it's sort of semi-commercial. It is an international airport, but it's mostly private jets that would be making those kinds of flights. And then there's a lot of general aviation, like propeller aircraft, a lot of freight. UPS comes in there, and DHL and other air freight. And then Boeing has the other half of it, and they use that for getting planes from post-production to the paint shop and back and forth. And other sort of, like, all the decals and things like that, I believe, are installed here. Like, a lot of the finish work for delivery, the commercial planes are delivered from here, or they end up here before they're delivered, and they go get a once through. And then there's also a lot of military stuff. And of course, now the Museum of Flight, which is a fantastic place to check out old machines and see them restored and be able to walk around and go in the cockpits and stuff.
Wow. And they've parked a whole bunch of 747 Maxes over there, too,
that
right?
That is so true. I saw a picture when we were traveling of the parking lot. It's actually an employee parking lot behind where Boeing headquarters was before they moved to Chicago. they had this enormous lot, and I saw in the photo, and I recognized the Duwamish River, and I said, geez, did they really park all of those? It seems they made sense. I thought a lot of the 737s, the MAX aircraft that were grounded, I thought a lot of them would end up in the desert, and places that are drier so that they can be stored or sort of frozen in time until they're allowed to fly again. But it turns out they kind of need all the space they can get, and I think there's like 50 of them parked in this employee parking lot just sitting here in the Pacific Northwest.
Where do the employees park?
I don't think they have as many employees there because they're factory spaces have been reconfigured and moved around in a lot of ways automated, and of course there's been attempts to do a lot of the manufacturing in other parts of the country, particularly the South. There's a Boeing plant down there, but it's not as easy to train people there. They've run into some difficulties with trying to replace the kind of workforce that you have here in the Northwest, because there's generations of people that have been working on aircraft. So, but they're constantly changing all of that, and of course managing it from Chicago. So
we parallel to I-5 right now, and I see a highway next to us.
Yeah, you're right. This is I-5. We drove on this a lot of times while we were visiting, and it's sort of a weird road, but yeah, it's done in sections. And it kind of crisscrosses at the end of Boeing Field here. We just went under it.
Wow. I also see a lot of people camping out. That looks like fun.
I saw one of those loaner bikes, just, you know, like the city bike type thing. Or I think they're called Lemon Bikes or whatever rideshare company it is this week. I saw one just thrown on the side of the train tracks as we were riding by.
Well, apparently you can just park those anywhere. You don't have to go to a stand to park them.
They say they have GPS, you know, and that's supposed to deter people from doing, you know, to have them... It's supposed to incline them to return them as they would want their program to work, but I think people just don't care.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be inclining them at all.
They just toss them in the river or whatever. It's pretty hilarious.
And Portland has a similar system, people just tossing things into the river. I don't know why.
Yeah, and with scooters particularly.
Well, I could see why people would throw scooters into the river, but bicycles, let's... Anyway, what part of...
The Tukwila transfer station. Look at all that garbage.
More garbage.
More
okay.
Garbage.
Wow, that is impressive. A lot more containers.
I didn't even know. I honestly didn't know they had a transfer station here, but it's great. It's so
you
fantastic.
You sound so proud
yeah,
of that.
You know what? There's nothing to be more proud of than garbage leaving the Pacific Northwest.
Here's a question, Kyle. Where do they send the garbage after they're done with it?
Out into parts of the state that don't really care about having huge festering pits in the ground with leachate leaking into the groundwater.
What part of the state could that possibly be where people don't care about that?
I don't know. Probably less progressive parts of the state. Because, you know, in honesty, they probably capture a lot of the natural gas and then turn that into jet fuel to go bomb people. I don't know what.
Wow, we sound dark today.
I haven't had my second cup of coffee.
We're having our first cup of coffee, though, and you got this down the hallway, right?
Yes, there's a coffee pot in our train, and they have pretty good coffee.
Ooh,
skate park, there you go. They're building another one of the sort of permanent skate parks under an overpass. There's another one in Seattle that's pretty renowned, built into and under Highway 99, right. Just south of the huge Starbucks building in Soto. So those overpasses tend to create a covered skate park. A lot of skate parks end up being exposed outdoors, and then when it rains, you can't skate. So building them under these overpasses allows them to be sort of outdoor, but also dry for the most part.
I learned a lot about train tracks on this trip. For instance, BNSF... which is Burlington Northern Santa Fe, I believe. They have one set of tracks. Union Pacific has another set of tracks. So you have a train crossing, and then a few feet later, you have another train crossing. I think Amtrak uses BNSF up here, but I'm seeing Union Pacific cars that we're passing right now. So maybe they switch on and off. But it's just fascinating to see all the different kinds of trains that go by on the one track. That we were broadcasting from earlier, You see Amtrak, you see the Seattle Sounder commuter rail, and you also see BNSF freight trains going by. And then a few feet down the road, there's the Union Pacific freight trains that go by. So it's a great city if you like trains.
Yeah, it's that corridor north-south that just has these tracks, many of them together, but also many different lines further apart, spread apart. There's an enormous distribution center in Kent along the way. We've talked about it, but it truly is massive. Basically, warehouses and sidings going to those warehouses as far as the eye can see. I mean, right now we're looking at little spurs that go off and go into these back sections of these warehouses, pull up right next to the roll-up doors, and may or may not be used for stuff, you know, were in the past, but some of them are actually still active.
Now, when you say warehouses, I think of Kent, so we must be near Kent.
Yeah, I was kind of transitioning to that, because this is it. This is Kent, I'm just looking at tons of sidings and places for manufacturers to get bulk deliveries and receive containers and so on.
I was going to say, we should see a sounder going by because it's still morning, but then I realized it's Saturday and they don't have sounders over the weekend unless there's some kind of a game, which is unfortunate because it's a great way to get back and forth from the outer parts to the city.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something we're always hoping is going to be increased. And we talked about previously the improvements they are making. So we'll keep hoping and wishing for continued development of that. We saw some cool projects, though. I believe we looked at, it was nighttime, but we saw some overhead structure for wiring going across the I-90 floating bridge from Mercer Island. That is going to be part of, I've been calling it East Side Access, but that's the name of the New York project.
You can't use that phrase. No, that's our phrase.
We got to come up with a different phrase. But what I mean is it's going to allow Link, the light rail system, to split off from Beacon Hill before it goes into Pioneer Square and to the International District. It'll allow it to split off and ride across the water using the floating bridge to get to Issaquah and to namely Bellevue, which is a very large city right sort of parallel to Seattle across Lake Washington.
Yeah, I saw that city for the first time. I didn't realize. Oh, hey. Is this lunch reservations?
Yeah.
Okay.
12 or 12:30.
Let's do 12 because we didn't need anything. Yeah, 12 o'clock is good.
So you know, how far are you going?
Sacramento.
Okay, so before you get out of the dining car for lunch, get a reservation for dinner. We'll have it set up.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I believe we just passed Kent Station.
The old Kent Station. There it is.
Wow. I'm after the virtual rail fan people to put a camera there. I really think that's a great location for train spotting.
It is. No, it's a truly charming little station. It's our favorite restaurants.
And yeah, we're seeing a lot of places that we were hanging out in. It's really cool to see on a train.
Such interesting weather. We finally got rain. I don't know if we mentioned that.
Yeah, on that subject, Kyle, you know, I was here for a solid 2 weeks, and not one day was there a drop of rain. It was sunny, it was bright, it was clear. And now, as we're leaving, it's suddenly the rain has come. It's not really heavy rain, it's just kind of drizzle. And a freight train is passing us right now as we're passing a whole bunch of warehouses in Kent. Boy, it's a rainy day, but I would like to have seen some actual rain because people are always complaining about that, and I didn't see it. And every time I come to Seattle, the same thing happens. It's pleasant. Well, I don't like the word pleasant, but it just happens to be the way it is.
These are oil tank cars. Some kind of oil is stored in that. Either feedstock.
Michael here in the dining car. I've gone to each and every bedroom, so if you are in the bedrooms and did not get a reservation for lunch in the bedrooms, if you did not get a reservation for lunch, please come to the dining car at this time.
Yeah, the reason I opted for an early reservation is because we arrive in Sacramento at 6 a.m. tomorrow, And it's not the last stop, so we have to be up for that. We have, I think, 5 hours in Sacramento to kill before our next train that goes to Chicago. It's actually the longest Amtrak daily route. There is a longer route, but it's not daily. But it goes from Sacramento all the way up to Chicago. We've never taken that route. I thought I had taken all the routes that went east-west, but apparently I missed that one. So I'm looking forward to that, but we do have to kill a few hours in Sacramento before we get on that one.
Indeed, yeah. It's going to be a whirlwind. That's something I'm looking forward to, though. Three different legs, a new line.
So I'm going to guess as to where we are now, because we just passed Kent, and we've been driving around for a couple of weeks now, so I'm starting to get the lay of the land. Are we near Auburn?
Yes.
Wow, I got it right. I can't believe it.
Yep. Auburn Airport should just be east of us, I think. We're passing by a bunch of warehouses. We actually went and visited a machine shop, or like a motor shop, that is located down here. Really renowned mechanic and engine builder who had moved here. So we're actually in and amongst some of these industrial areas.
It's weird because you see individual people like that guy we visited, running their own business and all that, kind of small but very talented. But then you see these massive warehouses that go on for, it seems, miles. And of course, Amazon is out here as well. I just wonder, what is it about this particular part of the country, this part of the state, that just draws everybody to have a warehouse here?
It's true. I'm always amazed at what people do with so little space. And some of those places are actually the best. The people, and you get that in New York a lot too. I mean, space is a premium. People learn to kind of navigate and really make use of whatever they have. And I like to bring some of that back here in the projects I do and the sort of attitudes, because I see it more. You know, I appreciate it more than perhaps not having seen it in the East and being able to recognize that, you know, people really are working hard trying to make a living and do the best they can. And it doesn't take much space. I think that's the other thing. But a lot of the way housing is set up, it's very hard to do some of the industrial stuffs and without a business or something that sustains that kind of space. But you're right, I think it also is a legacy of the aircraft industry and building and that kind of stuff, that people are very mechanically inclined and busy with projects like that.
We're passing the Auburn Sounder Station.
This is impressive. I've never seen it from this vantage. This is unique, seeing Auburn, you know, the old city, and going under State Route 18 right now. Here we are.
Oh, look at that.
18 is a great road. That goes all the way to I-90. You can kind of bypass going up to the city. So if you wanted to go to Eastern Washington, you could just take that two-lane road, and it would go all the way out to I-90, and then you'd be able to get over the mountain passes and into Eastern Washington and of course Idaho thereafter.
And of course I-90 goes all the way east too, and I-80 connects with that. You know, roads are fascinating to me as well, not quite as fascinating as railways, but it is kind of interesting. You see the different types of roads and highways here. You have the interstates, of course, you have the state roads, and then you have federal roads occasionally. We don't have any federal roads on Long Island, do you know that? Never had one.
That's an interesting point. I think you I remember you pointed that out and you had said that. I kind of understand it though. It is an island. I mean,
I guess, but you know, I don't really know that much about them because I don't have any nearby. But I know Federal Route 1 goes up and down the East Coast. So it's probably the closest one. And I think maybe 9 as well. Not really sure if that's a state road or a federal road. But if anyone out there has more info on the differences between federal and state roads, obviously they're maintained differently. But the history, because they predate interstates. So I guess federal roads, like Route 66, that I think was a federal road that had a song written about it. I've never heard a song about an interstate, but I'm sure somebody can correct me on that.
Truly, yeah. It's good to know these distinctions in so many ways. Things can differ
So now there's a whole bunch of freight trains next to us parked, and it looks like it's opened up quite a bit again.
Yeah, yeah. Getting back to the industrial work, I think that it's also an aspect of what we thought was the weather. People having projects and, like, wanting to work on things inside. Because even when I was a kid, you know, you'd have rainy days or whatnot, and you didn't play outside or something, so you'd work on art or work on projects inside. And I think people really like that kind of thing where you can kind of be outdoors but also go inside during the winter months or when it's, you know, nastier out and focus on something, a puzzle or problem solving, that kind of thing. And I think the weather being overcast occasionally, I know it wasn't at all when we were here, but when it is like this, rainy and so on, people like to be cozy and kind of go in and tinker with things. And I certainly love doing that, especially in the winter or the fall in the winter. And I know we were talking to some of my friends who were talking about Scandinavia, which is very similar in that way. People just working on projects and being crafty and craftspeople, putting together things and working on projects. And we do that often with some of the production and, of course, radio and other creative pursuits really lend themselves to that, because you get to focus on, you know, editing or artistic, you know, use of music and production.
Some takeaways that I have from spending time in this region, noticed a lot of Vietnamese places. And, you know, I've always been going on about how there weren't any Vietnamese places on Long Island, and now there are a few. But here, it seems like they're everywhere, and you have all kinds of variety in that. You've got places known as teriyaki shops, which sell a variety of food, but have a teriyaki theme to them. And you just see signs for teriyaki everywhere. That's unusual. And then you have these little espresso houses. These are my favorite. Think of the old photomat shops that used to be in parking lots in shopping centers. Now imagine a coffee shop as big as that. Now, of course, you don't go into it. You walk up to it or you drive up to it, and they sell espresso. They're everywhere. They're everywhere. Why don't we have these things? I think it would be so great to have. I mean, there was a couple of drive-up Starbucks, but they sure don't deserve the credit for this. These are independent. They're all different, and the coffee is pretty good, too.
Yeah, it's true. It's kind of a relic of the dot-com era and just the huge proliferation of people working in technology and stuff. And I think around that time, Seattle was really reaching sort of a epoch in coffee culture and a crescendo, of course, with Starbucks and, you know, the big coffee companies competing and duking it out for market share. Of course, Starbucks having dominated, I think, globally. But to that end, I mean, a lot of those espresso carts and so on were in front of malls, and they were in front of, you know, on street corners and stuff. Wow, that's very Twin Peaks.
I was just going to ask you, those big, enormous green trees, what do you call them?
They're fir trees. Douglas fir.
Douglas firs. Wow, imagine that. I know I want a donut for some reason.
You going to call me Diana?
No, it's Diane, by the way.
Diane, all right.
All right, enough of that. Another thing I noticed out here, which I'm fascinated by and which nobody else seems to appreciate, is the street numbering scheme. They have so many street numbers, it gets ridiculous. It's kind of, imagine Queens, all right? Queens has a lot of street numbers. They have avenues, they have streets, they have roads, they have drives, they have places, they have courts. They all have numbers. Same thing in at least the Seattle and surrounding area. I'm not sure about the rest of the state, but it gets kind of ridiculous because you're out in the country and you see 326th Street. Because I don't know if it goes all the way back to Seattle. I don't know where the origin is, but it's nothing but street numbers, avenues and street numbers, and just it gets really crazy.
You're walking through the business class and the coach section to take reservations for lunch. If you are in the coach and in the business class, we have an Angus cheeseburger, Angus burger, or a veggie burger for $12.50. You can add cheese, you can add bacon, you can add guacamole. The cosos are over and about. We also have an entree salad, that's $12.50. If you want to add a protein to it, chicken breast, that's $3.50 for a total of $16. But we also have steamed mussels. Those are $14.50. Everything is a la carte, folks. So if you want a beverage, that's an addition to it. Of course, service is also over and above. I'm going to come through the coaches this time and take reservations for lunch. If you'd like to eat in the dining car, please take a reservation. Thank you.
You know, we have not sampled the Amtrak mussels yet.
I'm going to steer clear of it. Something about it just seems like a big red flag. I don't know.
But somebody in Amtrak corporate had the idea to offer mussels on their trains. I think we should at least respect them enough to give it a try, and if it makes us horribly ill, we'll at least be able to report that.
I just want to know how long they've been sitting around in their own juices, and how long, I mean...
Talk about Amtrak employees or mussels?
I don't know. No comment.
Anyway, so to get back to the street numbers, yeah, it's weird if anybody understands how it works. It just seems like they have no street names, which I guess saves a lot of work. You don't have to name the streets, but it's also really weird because if you look at a map, you see like 248th Avenue out by somebody's farm, but it only goes the length of a block and then it stops. So is that the only 248th Avenue, or is there another piece of it somewhere else? You know, Google's no help with this at all, so if anybody can just explain it to me, that would be really, really cool. I would appreciate it. It's keeping me up at night. So now, is this still Sounder territory we're passing?
Yeah, we just went from Sumner, and now we're going through Puyallup.
Say that again?
Puyallup.
I don't think I can pronounce that. Wow.
Puyallup.
That's a great place to live. It looks really nice. How much further does the Sounder go?
I think Lakewood, maybe Olympia.
I know they're going to expand it. They're going to expand it.
It could have changed, yeah. There's a beetle there. Okay.
There's beetles everywhere. You just look around. That's why somebody surely must have gotten tired of their beetle by now, and maybe it's time that someone else gets some joy out of it. So please, keep us in mind. OTW@2600.com. We'd love to hear from you.
We'll come pick it up.
We'll get it from you. Yes, we'll take it. You know, it doesn't even have to have an engine. We can figure out how to fix that.
No, we got a quote on some new like 1600cc engines without a core. If you have an engine and it doesn't work, that would help us on the engine price. That would cut that price down because you bring the old one in and then they can rebuild it, so you can end up giving them another motor that they can sell, so that they'll knock the price down off that.
Yeah, if you have a bug or a bus that has an engine that doesn't work, we'll fix it for you, and then we'll keep it.
Engines are not a problem.
Yeah, so don't worry about that. Have we hit Tacoma yet, or are we about to?
Yeah, we're about to.
Okay. Tacoma's a lot closer to Seattle than I thought it was. In fact, the airport is named SeaTac, Seattle-Tacoma.
That's right. Yeah, those are sort of the two main cities. Tacoma being sort of in the south, very bottom of Puget Sound. Like, if you're looking at a picture of Washington State, you see kind of a peninsula, and then you see a waterway towards the left, and it goes from the top where Canada might be all the way down into... about 60% down the state, I guess, and that last little part is adjacent to Oregon, but Tacoma's at the bottom of where the waterway comes in from the ocean up in the Strait of Juan de Fuca and San Juan area. That's the main access to the Pacific.
And we still have a couple hours to go through Washington. We're passing the city called Vancouver, which I think they named it that just to confuse people, because it's obviously not the Vancouver, but it's in the southern part of Washington, right across the river from Portland. And we spent some time in Portland on this trip on the way up here. So it'll be nice to pass by there and see some familiar sights as well. But I gotta tell you, just sitting here in the train, watching the scenery go by, there is no better way to view America than this. So I'm really thrilled to be doing that. And one other thing I just wanted to point out too before we go is we were talking about museums and old machines. There is no better way to appreciate technology than to go to the Living Computer Museum.
Absolutely. I'm so thrilled that we got a chance to visit and check it out finally. I'd worked at the Museum of Communications, which is a telephone museum in Georgetown, and a lot of the friends and volunteers I met there were also working on projects for the Living Computer Museum, some of them full-time. So there's some really incredible talent at both museums, and I never had really ventured over there. I knew what they were doing. I knew they were acquiring as many of these old machines, much in the same way as our friends at the Vintage Computer Fair do. They rescue pallets and pallets of old mainframes and stuff like that and restore them and get them working again. This facility, though, was funded in large part by Paul Allen and a lot of his colleagues through Microsoft and of course Bill Gates and many, many others. And that facility basically has an example of all types of computers. I thought it was mainly multi-user machines. They do have an example of pretty much every multi-user machine there was, all the machines that were precursors to sort of the modern Linux and Unix variants that we use today. But they also include video game consoles. They include PC clones and every Mac variant you can think of. Historic Macs are there on display, and they're working, all of them, and you can touch stuff.
Yeah, I actually got to use the very first computer I ever had contact with, which was a DEC 10. Well, DEC 10 is the operating system. PDP 10 was the computer. I'm not entirely sure, to be honest, but I just remember the prompt was a period. And I actually got to play with a machine that did that and see some familiar commands from my high school days. And that really was, I've been trying to do that for many years, but I actually got to not only type some things in, but to see what the machine looked like, which was huge. It took up a room. And, in high school, back at Ward Melville High School in the late 70s, that is what we connected to via modem. We didn't have the computer ourselves. It was a system called Lyrics Time Sharing. Which I think was in Bohemia, someplace like that. We would connect over that at 300 baud, which was fast compared to the other schools. I know Port Jefferson, they had these clunky teletype machines that went at 110 baud. We had deck writers, which was state-of-the-art, and they went 300. And, it was just... It's impossible to convey the emotion you feel, or just the... the sense of adventure you feel when you see a machine typing something based on what you've said to it. And it's going at a speed where you can read it as it's printing. But you ask yourself, how do I change this to make it do that? It just seems like we don't have that same type of appreciation anymore. Not in the same way for other more advanced things, but it's just that basic, how do I print this particular phrase, and how do I change it to print that particular phrase? So anyway, it's just it brought all that back to me, and it was really a cool thing. So yeah, if you're in Seattle, Living Computer Museum is a great place to go. It was cool to see a lot of kids there too, playing with computers. Also, they have autonomous car simulations, so they're looking into the future as well. I played with that. I sat in the driver's seat, and I tried to crash, but I couldn't. they kept me from doing that. Wasn't too impressed with it, to be honest. But then again, I'm not too impressed with the technology yet. I'm sure I will be. But you had fun too, right?
Oh, I really enjoyed it, and I love the displays and showing period stuff like for the next generation, especially that educational aspect. They can see what kinds of things that people were using and how they were using it, what their living rooms might have looked like, and that way they can kind of, or also the larger machines, they can kind of see what the researchers did before the stuff had been miniaturized, and follow that progression of innovation and material sciences too, going from different things, different types of chips and sizes and cooling requirements and processing speeds and so on. See just how large they were early on, and then how small everything got, and what led to it. What innovations progressed and supported each evolution to the next phase and the next capability. That, you know, is really hard to sum up. And I knew about a lot of those systems, but I had to read about it in encyclopedias. I had to open books or watch terrible, you know, Discovery documentaries, or, you know, I would just soak up as much of that history as I could in bits and pieces. But to have it all laid out as a young person, I think that's a really valuable way, especially if you're fascinated by technology and it really inspires you. You can see yourself in some of the early innovators and what they were like, you know, putting things together. There's tons of photographs and stuff, guys chomping on pipes in universities and just doing unusual things. You remarked about what that must have been like, about how people must have looked at them.
Well, yeah, there was a picture of these, I guess you'd call them nerds, inside a computer room looking at printouts and big machines all around them. And looking at them, you realize, yeah, these are the misfits. These are the people that nobody sat next to at lunch. These are the people that everybody thought was completely wasting their time. Familiar with it, you know, been dealing with that for quite some time on many levels and through many different people. We all kind of have experienced that to some degree. But then you realize, look at what has been built. Look at what those people did. Look at the technology around us today. And it puts it into perspective. Those guys weren't wasting their time at all. They were pursuing a passion. And if you have a passion, you have something that other people think is a waste of time, you keep pursuing that. You keep looking into what you can do and making it better. So it's a real inspiration, and I hope a lot of kids got that message looking at that place. And speaking of kids, there was a picture there too of Paul Allen and Bill Gates. Bill Gates was a little kid, and Paul Allen was a teenager. But they were working, I didn't know this, they were working together, looking at some kind of printout on some kind of machine. You could see the fascination in Bill Gates' eyes. I think he was like 9 or 10 or something. And they went on to work together throughout that period and beyond. And I thought that was really incredible. There's also a letter to Paul Allen from University of Washington, basically kicking him out of the computer room because he was abusing his privileges and using all the printers. It's really a funny letter. It's worth it just to go there and read that letter that's posted on the wall. But again, you know, getting in trouble, that's not necessarily something that's bad. Sometimes it's the right thing, and in this particular case, it certainly was. And it's, you look back on that, I'll bet the person who wrote that letter, if they're still around, is definitely blushing at the fact that they kicked Paul Allen out of the computer room.
It's cool, though, that he was keeping that from younger people, or at least holding the door open, even when the grown-ups or whatever authority figures are trying to, like, clamp down. It's like that opportunity was more important, and the work they were passionate about was more crucial. And by being able to work together to share in that learning, and like I said, hold the door, you know, keep
keep the access to the tools available in ways that they weren't really intended, that's incredible. And that's a spirit that I think lives on. There's always people, especially in the hacking community, that are interested in sharing what they know and showing people what's sort of behind the curtain and what you can do when you think about things in unusual ways or in ways that other people aren't thinking about them.
Yeah, imagine if Paul Allen had said, yeah, I'm not going to share this info with some 10-year-old kid and he's wasting my time. who knows where Bill Gates would have gone? We might not have a Microsoft, and some people might say that's a good thing, but the point is, he obviously had skill, he obviously had talent, and he was encouraged, and that's a good thing, and it's important to have that positive reinforcement that comes out of technology many times.
And that spirit and excitement for it probably motivated Paul Allen in turn. I mean, it's a sort of reciprocal thing when you're a fledgling team building something you don't really know where it's going to go.
The other thing I saw there that they focused a lot on were punch cards and how punch cards were programmed. You'd go to a keyboard and you type things and little holes were punched into the cards. And I remember this, my first year at Stony Brook.
And our coach accommodations, if you just joined us, you can see we are a sold-out train. Please sit in those assigned seats. We're going to use each and every seat available today because, once again, we're a sold-out train here on the train. So please sit in those assigned seats. Place those colorful tickets above your seat. That will save your indicational seat. Thank you.
And, you know, I remember the punch card machines at Stony Brook when I first came there. I wasn't a computer person. I didn't use the computer system at Stony Brook, but I was aware of it. And just seeing those machines again was really interesting. And people used to walk around the campus with boxes of punch cards. That was their computer program. Their computer program was in a box, and it was. You know, a real labor-intensive chore to have that fed into the machine, and you'd wait for the dispatch from the line printer to see if something was executed properly. To me, it just seemed very boring, not at all what hacking is all about, but still fascinating to a degree. So it's amazing to see those tools actually restored in great condition. They really have kept these machines in amazing condition. And as Kyle said, you can touch them, and you can see what they're like, and just look at the technology and how it's changed. And yes, in our smartphones, there's more power than in many of those mini computers that are currently working there. Anyway, we've talked ourselves all the way down to Tacoma, so we're going to refresh our coffee and take a break, maybe walk around the cars a little bit as we get to know the Pacific Coast Starlight, or is it just the Coast Starlight?
Coast Starlight.
The Coast Starlight, which goes down the Pacific Coast. We'll be getting off tomorrow morning in Sacramento and heading east. And we'll keep checking in.
Yes, there's many, many more stories from our adventures to share, and lots of insight, lots of cool things that we observed and that we're thinking about coming away from this.